We've had a couple of very good guests on this morning that talked about subjects that weren't necessarily good when we started, but we finished on a happy note with both of them about positive change, and that's going to continue today. In an environmental and sustainability gentleman who's been with us many times before, Kevin O'Grady, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rob. Good to be back.
Great to have you too, and well, really enjoyed our conversations previously, and we did have a little bit of a discussion via email about putting some positive tone into it, and you've got some really good stories coming out of two fields in particular. But let's look at forestry management, always a big issue in Australia, logging in Victoria and logging around the place, and internationally the Amazon forest is a serious issue. But you've got some positive stories.
Yeah, I do indeed. Look, and even a Geelong-based story, which is even better. So what happens was that the Forest Stewardship Council way back in 1994 developed a policy, and the idea was to eliminate use of chemicals on forestry. Now that was a lofty goal. None of us like chemicals because they could be environmentally damaging and they cost a lot of money. So everyone agrees they should be gone. But the problem was how and what, and replace them with what. You know, at the moment, that's a long-term goal. To replace them, it's what's called a theory of change. But in the meantime, we've got to do as much as we can to reduce, remove, and replace. Now, back in 2016, I think it was, there was a poisoning event. There's some water from the Coingeborah Reservoir, which feeds the Geelong water catchment, was poisoned accidentally with something called hexazinone, only to detectable traces. But that kind of set the hairs running. And Forest Stewardship had produced a list of chemicals that they said you shouldn't use ever. And, you know, the forestry companies, and I was involved in forestry at the time, said, look, let's look at a continual improvement approach rather than a banning approach. Otherwise, we just can't take part. Anyway, that movement became, and I was the leader of that movement, became bigger and bigger and bigger. And it started basically, I think we had forest companies from 22 different countries, all forest stewardship managed. They were all taking on this goal. The practical upshot was of the 35 chemicals of concern, we retired 19 of them globally. And that's amazing. You know, that's a huge thing. And the rest are now under a policy of what we call reduce, remove and replace, where we've got them focusing on trying to get rid of them. So that's hugely positive. But consider this, which is that forestry in Australia and worldwide is 0.7%, less than 1% of total agrochemical use. So if we could take our experience and take it into the agriculture and farming model, it would have a huge impact on reducing chemicals. And that was done because Forest Stewardship Council have a focus on chemicals. You know, they have a focus on this sort of thing. So that's a really good news story from there.
Kevin, just on that, you would have had to have changed some pretty strong cultural thinking within the industry. How do you go about starting off to do that? Because what you've achieved is clearly extraordinary, and you're very, very proud, but it's got to have started by really challenging some people's inherent behaviours.
On both sides, yes. We've said before that we don't like chemicals, which is we being forest companies, because they can they cost a lot of money, basically, and then they're difficult to manage. And, of course, for the environmental and social side, it's an absolutely holy grail issue. They believe there should be no chemicals at all. We should be totally organic. And that's not realistic, not at least in my lifetime. So, yes, we had to take people forward like that. But you'd be surprised. The forest companies are looking at this quite strongly. And one amazing example was that in Western Australia, an Australian forest company had something like 50% loss of seedlings due to African black beetle biting off the top of the seedlings. So they used a chemical called chlorophos, but it was only 50% effective, so it was expensive and ineffective. They invented something that looks like the little bag that you get around your duty-free, except it was made of a biodegradable plastic, and it created a 100% physical barrier so the beetle couldn't get at it, 100% effective, zero chemicals, retired $200,000 per application of chemicals, got rid of that, replaced it with these little bags. And, you know, in sustainability, social issues are really good things to concentrate on. Well, and they gave the contract to make those to a disability support factory that used people with disabilities to produce that. So it was a double, triple whammy. And that happened here in Australia.
So how do you start to drive that sort of change, though? Because That's massive.
I know. That's a good question. So, and believe it or not, what we did was we formed a delegation called the Kansas Delegation, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, US, and we went with a delegation of about 8 of us from across the world, across those companies, to Bonn in Germany, where the Forest Stewardship Council is, to talk to the board about, you've got the wrong way of doing things, don't ban things, look at what we're doing here. And we used that African black beetle as an example. And we said, look at what we can do. So they've gone to a continual improvement, what's called the theory of change, which is that change will happen, but incrementally. And you've got to keep your eye on the ball to make those changes happen. So we've now got a continual improvement in the risk management strategy, which is far more effective than banning. Of course, as you say, that people were far more accepting of it than just saying, one side saying you shouldn't use chemicals and the other side saying we've got to. So it's been a big thing, and I myself developed a database for Forest Stewardship Council of alternatives to chemicals. I think there's 150-something alternatives in there, just by looking around and sharing that information. So that was the forest companies actually changing the thinking of the standards body.
So, Kevin, you've got rid of 19 of 30-odd, so let's say there's 15 or 16 to go. Are you working on a similar sort of potential change and now just a matter of selling the concept?
The policy now is for absolute prohibition of certain things. DDT, for example, can't use that. Paraquat, you can't use that. You know, that's no one's arguing about that. But then putting the others in the spotlight as they're restricted or highly restricted, and those are the ones we want to get rid of. And so that's the focus is on that. And again, they're renewing this idea of sharing alternatives and sharing research. You know,
it's really good that you've been able to make the start. So one of the things that intrigues me now that you've found a way through and you've convinced, well, if you like, people on the other side that there is alternatives, is that going to make your next negotiations so much easier with both parties open to change?
Oh, look, myself and the Forest Stewardship Council go way back and we've got a good rapport. I've actually worked with them. I worked with them on the pesticide policy, on one of their working groups, and I worked with them on something called controlled wood, which is avoiding the worst excesses of bad forestry. So I've got a good reputation, and yeah, it makes it very easy for me to go and negotiate with them on things, and the current thing we're talking about is improving stakeholder communication, people telling people about these issues and getting them involved in them. So, no, it does make it easier. A track record is good, and also the willingness and the openness of the companies to do that. So, as I said, we're 0.71% of chemical use globally and nationally. The minute we stuck our head above the parapet, all of the environmental groups came in with full guns. And, you know, that was a scary place for a short while, but we did, you know, as I said to you before, sustainability is a three-cornered stool, environmental, social,
yeah,
and economic. So you've got to talk about things. And just by talking about it, yeah, we had some absolute ding-dongs, but yeah, we got through. Everyone's agreed on chemicals.
Yeah, it's good. Just on that, we know it's a constant debate, environmental groups and trees. It's the whole thing about you can't cut down trees, but industry and society needs timber in so many different formats. Are we getting really close to that sustainable balance going forward to meet the needs of both parties?
There is a large amount of what we call Forest Stewardship Council, FSC, and another organisation, PEFC, wood around. And you'll see that especially on pulp and paper and books and all that sort of things. And people do now choose that because they realise what it is. So, for example, J.K. Rowling insisted that the last three, I think, Harry Potter books be printed on FSC certified paper. So, you know, people are really responding to that. And, yeah, it's making a difference. Globally, it's making a difference. Because there is a focus on environmental and social issues to get certified. And it's no easy matter being certified. I'm working through with a company in Northern Territory at the moment to get their plantation certified, and it is a major effort. It's a sea change in the way in which you approach forestry. And just since I've been in there, the degree of improvement in forestry practices in Australia has been amazing. People, you know, looking out for koalas, which they got to do, and some were caught out not looking after them, which was even, you know, that highlighted it, but again, that's the standard doing that. And then, you know, looking after cultural heritage sites and all this, you wouldn't read about the sort of things that they do now. Didn't happen many years ago, but it happens now.
Another important thing that we minions, it's the little change that we can make that makes a difference. So if you look at it and say, well, if I don't recycle, it won't make much difference. But if everyone takes ownership of, and that paper usage that you spoke about is one way where people just in their shopping practices and lifestyle practices can make significant change to a market if you multiply that by a million users, can't it? It's just a matter of being disciplined.
Your listeners should look at the toilet paper when they next go shopping. Kimberly Clark aligned with WWF and Forest Stewardship to make sure all the tissue is carrying that FSC logo. Other companies had to follow suit, so it's, you'll see that little FSC tree tech all the way through the tissue department. Now, they raised the category environmentally. They raised that category globally into a sustainable category. So, you know, that's consumer pressure and companies reacting really well.
Let's change tack to the water retention. I suppose in Australia, the Murray-Darling Basin's had a lot of media and yeah. Not a lot of it's been good. You know, the think that we've got water being stored up to water cotton, and you've got a town like Wilcannia that had to have water trucked in so people could drink, and they're on a river. It just seems totally illogical. But we've got to be getting better in this space, and hopefully you've got some suggestions. We are.
Yeah, well, we've got something called the Alliance for Water Stewardship, which I work strongly with, and a really good example, a good news example, is in Renmark Irrigation Trust, and they're a trust representing something like 200 growers, and they manage the water coming off the Murray, and they pump it to the individual irrigators. They work with them on timing the irrigation, best use, crop needs, and all that sort of stuff to maximise and optimise the water use. They're looking at water stewardship. They're also obliged to talk to other stakeholders and see whether what we call shared challenges. And one of those stakeholders was Renmark City Council. And Renmark City Council had a plan, it was about 2017, they had a plan called Renmark 2020. And they had a lot of areas which were now quite dry, Thompson's Lake and other places like that, which they wanted to renovate or regenerate in order to create tourism areas. That was their 2020 goal. And the Renmark guys turned up because Water Stewardship said you've got to be involved with stakeholders and said, well, we've got 200 kilometres of piping of water and part of the irrigation is maintenance. Is you've got to flush those pipes out to get the sand and silt out to make them work properly. So where do you want the water? And there was one of those situations where they go, can you say that again? And said, you want the water. Now, they achieved their 2020 vision in 2019. Because Renmark Irrigation just filled up Thompson's Lake. Now they're looking at, they've done five more places like that, and the city council have built walkways and caravan parks and things to complement it. So that 2020 vision, by this company working harder and smarter, they were able to basically restore an important water-related values. So, I mean, that was huge. I think there's about nine more that they're doing. So if you take that with other irrigation trusts and get them to do the same things, that in terms of what the environmental flows in the Murray-Darling Basin and what it's meant for would be an absolutely ideal way of dealing with it. And the model's right there.
There's certainly been some skullduggery that's gone on. That's been brought to the attention and hopefully people have been suitably embarrassed and humiliated and maybe even hauled over the legal coals. But is that still the biggest danger maybe to a system that works well is the opportunity to steal water that should otherwise be used for other purposes?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, the Murray-Darling Basin is an interesting concept. And the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is also interesting, but you've got human nature involved as well. The advantage of what Renmark are doing, for example, and interestingly enough, Renmark City Council themselves are going to get a water stewardship certificate, and some of the growers who work with Renmark are going to get a water stewardship certificate. The advantage of these independent standards is that they are market-driven independent standards, not governmental rules or whatever, and you're doing them to get the benefit in terms of you know, the water savings and the community benefits and all those sorts of things, which actually add up to money as well. You know, environmental benefits is something called environmental services, and sometimes people pay for those environmental services. So it becomes an independent, separate from government, separate from regulation, incentive to do the right thing. Now, if you're not on board with that, and you're out one of those people, as you say, like we saw up in the Cottonlands, people stealing water, it's all bad. There's no upside at all. So there's a big thought process of industries getting involved and saying, we can basically admit Renmark that we're at the other end of the Murray-Darling, which is where it's meant to be, you know, the tail end of the pipe, as it were. They're proving that they can do it the best than anybody, even in the environment they're in. So more people do that, the more we might solve our problems. But you know, I've got some other really good examples of that in the water space as well, and these are offshore examples. And one I'm particularly proud of, in 2010 I went to Lake Naivasha, which is in Kenya. It's where they make the Born Free movies.
Yep.
And it's a massively important lake, and it's got huge environmental values, but it is surrounded by something like 35 large flower farms who produce cut flowers for the European market. And we went there, at Marks and Spencer's Centre, actually, to make sure that these people were doing the best thing they could with water conservation and making sure no chemicals got back into the environment and all of that sort of thing. So we did that. And they were world-class, absolutely world-class. But then we looked at it a bit more, and we found that their solid waste that came off their plants went to municipal collection, and they hadn't considered it. And then we followed that municipal waste back to a municipal processing centre, which didn't work, and we found that all they did with the solid waste was dump it in the lake. So we went back to the companies and said, you know, you guys have got some responsibility under water stewardship here, and they said, bloody oath we have. We're the biggest show in town. We're 35 billion Kenyan shillings. So they went to the government and said, fix it. And now Lake Naivasha has a brand new water processing plant to the benefit of 200,000 people. And I'm very pleased to be involved in that. And because the water stewardship drive, without that, that probably wouldn't have happened.
So out of absolute need around the globe, are you sensing that there's a lot of environmental issues, but water is just... is a human need. It's not even negotiable. We have to have it. So are you thinking that just out of sheer necessity, this sort of sensible, practical, positive investment is carried out more regularly?
You'd hope so. But again, it's the market that drives it. So Nestle Water are getting all their plants certified to the Water Stewardship Standard because they're in bottled water, and bottled water's on the nose. So they need to demonstrate. They have an absolute need to demonstrate that they're best in class to counter any sort of negative impacts because they're a massive global corporate and they're being accused of sucking all their local aquifers dry to the detriment of the local people. So they have to have this to prove that. But there's other groups who are looking at single issues and using water stewardship or sustainable water approach to try and address that. And I was very pleased to be involved in an audit of a very tiny hospital in Wick in Scotland, which is about as far north as you can go without getting your feet wet. And then NHS Highlands were doing a water stewardship plan to look at a particular issue, which is unresolved pharmaceuticals in the waterways. And I learned that when you take a pill, less than 30% of it is absorbed and the rest goes out into the waterways and can be detected. And then people do something called crush and flush, which they've got old pills, they just chuck them down the toilet. So we've got a universal problem around the world of unresolved pharmaceuticals in the waterways, so much so that Sydney can determine how much narcotics are being sold by testing the waterways because they know.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. So we've got this problem, and what NHS did was found out, working with their municipal water treatment people, they found out that there is no current treatment that can take, say, like ibuprofen, out of the water. But now, with this focus on pharmaceuticals and unresolved pharmaceuticals, which is a global problem, there are research projects going on, too, in the United States, actually focusing on treatments that will remove pharmaceuticals from waterways. So here we've got a global problem. A tiny little hospital in Scotland has decided to use water stewardship to highlight it, and they've gone to solve the problem. And as a result of that, we could be moving towards not having ibuprofen in the waterways.
You may not be able to answer this question, but this is one that pops up in my very basic layman conversations down here. We recently watched a big chunk of Queensland and northern New South Wales under flood, and we know damn well that water all runs out to sea, and then in 6 months' time, those same regions will be screaming because they're in drought again. The layman just asks, well, why don't you just build more dams and retain more of this water? Is that even remotely practical?
Look, it carries all sorts of issues, and I'm not an engineer, and I don't know those catchments of concern. But when we do work with water stewardship, and I'm talking about, or with water, and I'm talking about the Northern Territories at the moment, and they get wet season, dry season, they get just exactly what you're talking about. Then there is what we call shared challenges. Seasonal floods are shared challenges, and so farmers share those challenges. And communities share those challenges, and seasonal droughts are like that as well, and they share the challenges as well. And that's sort of another example that I've got, which was in the Middle East. You can imagine the Middle East is very, very dry, and what they've done is they've gathered the information, and they know where literally every drop of water is. A lot of it's an underground aquifer, and so what happens is in the wet spells, when you do get quite a bit of water standing, they actually drill and they inject it into the aquifer for later on. So these are amazing.
Ah, that's sensible.
Yeah, they drill it in for later on. But the more important point is they know where every skerrit of water is and where it should be. And as I said, they've got water issues. Of course they have.
Because I lived in a part of South Australia where flood irrigation was an enormous part of their viability around the town, and the water was very close to the surface, but over the years that water table has dropped and dropped and dropped, and I'm sure some sensible person knows where the water in that water table comes from, but it's nowhere near the area where they're taking it from. To be able to top up something like that with this ground, these incredible large amounts of groundwater that appear would be very, very sensible and practical.
If anybody's listening and can talk to me about getting in touch with these people. It's an amazing technique. I've never ever heard of it before. And they also have an ancient Arab technique of taking water and running it into through channels and into collection points as well. That's goes back millennia. So there are those solutions. It's like me going to FSC and telling them about how we control black beetles without chemicals. They didn't know about it.
Yeah, that's right.
To tell them.
Yeah, well, it's about education. In a lot of cases, we're probably already invented the wheel in some other part of the world. It's just picking up, and people like you who do travel the globe and have these experiences and able to take them to different regions are so vital to our future. So you keep up the good work that you do. We'll be in touch again for another chat, because you've finished again on a really positive note. There's good stuff happening in a space that is a bit frightening normally. So keep up the good work, Kevin O'Grady, and thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
All the very best. Kevin O'Grady, sustainability expert, and he's doing really, really good stuff, not just on our back door, but right around the globe.